It's a very remote place. It doesn't have a stoplight, and yet it becomes this place that people go to for this peculiar 100-year-old phenomena, which is, that a tornado hit the town 3 years in a row on the same day. Yeah, I was just sort of drawn to how that becomes the identity for this little dot in Kansas.
Tornadoes can have a devastating impact on individuals and communities, lasting long beyond the destruction they bring on any given day. But the impact of tornadoes, especially in the Tornado Alley of the Plains and Midwest, lasts beyond just physical damage. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today, we're speaking with Curtis Miller, the director of a documentary about tornadoes, history, and culture. It is featured in the 2026 Heartland Hawk Film Festival.
My name's Curtis Miller. I'm a filmmaker and educator who lives in Chicago, Illinois, and currently teach at Northwestern University in the Department of Art Theory and Practice, where I'm a photography instructor. And I'm excited to show A Brief History of Chasing Storms with Heartland Community College. This is my first feature, and I'm really looking forward to visiting Normal.
The subject of the documentary is tornadoes, and I understand that your hometown had a bad storm back in the in 2005. Did people still talk about that in your hometown?
It depends. You know, I think if you were directly impacted by it, you know, it haunts you for sure. Certainly people who lost their homes and things, it's a sticky subject that comes up from time to time. But a lot of my experience with that storm is that it's not discussed very often. And that was partly the beginnings of this project, because despite what its name suggests, this film is really more about the ways that storms sort of filter into the culture of a community and how they're memorialized and these sorts of things. And I think the lack of a large memorial for this event, which killed over 20 people, the lack of that locally where I grew up is partly what drew me to these places where it does get memorialized. So yeah, I think that people sometimes talk about it indirectly, you know, that this church used to be there, or, you know, they'll remark it when driving through. I've driven through some neighborhoods where people assume that it's a new development because there are no trees, that sort of thing. And then you have to, that's where the tornado comes up, right? Is sort of, you talk about it through your personal knowledge and the absence of things that you see, rather than a presence of a memorial or a mural or these sorts of things. So yeah, people do talk about it, but it's kind of in a coded sort of indirect way a lot of times.
In the movie, you have footage and have visited a number of towns where tornadoes made an impact on the town and its history. And I think that what is interesting is how many of these towns have that ingrained in their sort of small town culture. For instance, there's a town in Kansas that you visit, and it was hit by tornadoes in consecutive years on the same date for three consecutive years, which was May 20th, by the way. But this happened like 100 years ago, but they have it's commemorated.
And yeah, I mean, that sculpture in the film is not very old, too. It was only erected, I think, less than 5 years ago. It was delayed because of the pandemic. I think it was, they did their ceremony in 2021 for that. So it's not even that old, right? This is an event that happened at the beginning of the 20th century. And there aren't even that many people who live in the area now. There's 49 people reported to live in Codal, Kansas. And the way that I found out about it is when I was traveling and doing some location scouting, I just started sort of scouring Roadside America's website for peculiar tornado related attractions. And I was like, what is this? I mean, cause it's really far removed. Codal is pretty remote. I think maybe the largest town out there is Dodge City, and that's more than 100 miles away from it. So it's a very remote place. It's an unincorporated territory or community. It doesn't have a stoplight. And yet it becomes this place that people go to for this peculiar 100-year-old phenomena, which is, yeah, that a tornado hit the town 3 years in a row on the same day. And yeah, I was just sort of drawn to how that becomes the identity for someone like me for this little dot in Kansas. You know, this film is more about it's a kind of record keeping of these places and sort of allows the audience to kind of muse on what that might mean. But it would be interesting to talk to someone who was responsible for organizing this to find out exactly what the motivations were, because yeah, it's kind of odd to do this 100 years out. Because even when you're thinking about driving traffic to the town, I don't know what you would drive it to, because there isn't even a gas station in Kodal. Like, there's nothing to spend money on there. People live there. Like, there are homes, and there's a high school that's been turned into a community center, and that's where the statue is, the sculpture is. But yeah, as like a tourist trap, it's not clear why they need it, you know, because it's not like it's near a restaurant or something.
It seems to be like one of those Guinness World Records things. It could be the world's largest ball of twine or something. But as you say, there's about, 50 or 60 people that live there. But it's almost as if the town might have completely fallen into total obscurity if it weren't for this weird thing that happened 100 years ago.
Yeah, and the other thing I'll say, too, that was funny is I was there for a few hours because I was waiting for the clouds to look a certain way. And there was actually a storm kind of building off in the distance. And I was hoping that maybe fortune would bring that into the background. And so I was there for a little while, and I had like a handful of teenagers and children ride past on four wheelers, and they like totally ignored me. Like, I think they're used to people like me stopping and taking photos or filming it or whatever. And I wasn't even a curiosity for them. So it's interesting that there's this magnet that brings people in, but even the locals are kind of like maybe not that interested in engaging with the people that are drawn in.
So you mentioned the tourist trap element of it, and in one of the towns that you visited for the movie, where one of the most deadly storms in American history hit, they sell tornado-themed merchandise. It's like part of the town where, which is very interesting. This is a very deadly storm, but yet you can get, I don't know, a little spoon or something like that that has a tornado.
Yeah, they have tornado shot glasses. Yeah, Woodward was the most devastating tornado in Oklahoma's history, which also then puts it at one of the most deadly storms in U.S. history, because Oklahoma's had so many deadly storms. So I don't think it's the deadliest for the continent, but it's up there. And you see that a lot in Oklahoma, where gas stations and stuff have postcards with tornadoes and stuff on them. So it's not really a surprise to see that small museum in Woodward has it. And they do actually have, it didn't make it into the film, but they do have a very small display that commemorates the Woodward tornado in the museum. But it's also where they house all the old newspapers, microfilm and stuff like that. And that's what makes it into the film, is I go there to kind of look at the microfilm to see how it was reported on the day after. And the museum itself is sort of dedicated to the town's founding and the kind of history of the land rushes and stuff that happened in that area, because it's in a part of Oklahoma that was established through the land rush system. And so most of the museum is about that and about the founding people and some anecdotal stuff about cowboys and bank robbers and stuff like that. But it's also where they house the kind of the archive, the local archive of the tornado. And yeah, but within that is shot glasses and postcards and things with the name Oklahoma and then a tornado ascribed to it. Because, you know, the state really sort of embraces it as part of its idea. And so does Kansas, at least at an official level, even though, you know, from talking to locals, it's a relationship that they don't always love, you know, they don't always want it, because it can feel sort of reductive for them or whatever. Oh, this is just the middle of America where tornadoes happen.
Oklahoma and Kansas also have these pop culture tornado touchstones. And in Oklahoma, there's a town where it was the site of the filming, one of the sites of the filming of the movie Twister, the original one from the 90s. And there's a whole little mini museum all about the movie Twister in this Oklahoma town, where that town, I don't think, was ever hit by a tornado, but it did have like a bad storm that that affected them economically. So the movie coming to this town actually helped them out economically, from one of the people you interviewed said that.
Linda Wade is one of the people that I interviewed. And as she puts it, you know, they were hit by a bad hailstorm, which hailstorms we get around here as well. But like in Oklahoma and the Texas panhandle, sometimes hail is grapefruit sized, you know, like it can be very, very damaging. And they had a really bad storm and it damaged a bunch of buildings that were already empty. The town was already experiencing a decline, like a lot of small towns that were organized around farming in the plains, where the farms were getting bigger, which was good for a select few of farmers. But as it became more of a monocrop system of large farms, a lot of the smaller farms started to shut down. And so the town was already on under economic pressure. And then the storm hit and it damaged a lot of the buildings, and they pitched it to whoever from Warner Brothers was doing location scouting. And yeah, there were a variety of reasons of why Wichita was chosen beyond what Linda says. It's also because it's close enough, but far enough away to an interstate to allow them to get their equipment there, but also far enough away that they can control noise and traffic and so on and so forth. So the road that runs through Wichita is not a major thoroughfare, so they could shut it down for weeks at a time to construct the big disaster scene. It was a town that was like willing to let them take over, even though the two people I interview have fairly positive experiences with it. But I did meet some folks who were just kind of annoyed that it happened, you know, because they really did take over the town for like a whole summer, and it really controlled how people could move through the town and so on and so forth. But the building where the museum is also functioned as the primary production office for the location shooting, because not everything happened in Oklahoma. A lot of it did, but they also filmed as far north as Iowa, throughout Kansas. There are like maps online that you can find of all the locations where things were filmed. A lot of the big dramatic scenes that had to be filmed in front of a green screen and stuff were just done in California. But they did film a majority of the movie in the plains, because so much of it takes place outside. So they had to do a lot of location shooting. There actually aren't a lot of interior sets. But yeah, it's an interesting town to visit, because sort of similar to the way I described my hometown, is even when you're walking around Wichita, a lot of what's described to you on a walking tour is where things used to be, because they tore all the sets and stuff down. And they just have these small photos in empty plots that sort of represent where a house used to be that was featured in the film. The person who gives us the walking tour, that's not like his job. He is Dwight Bushman. He grew up in Wichita, and he was kind of like a PA on the film when it happened. And he is still kind of an aspiring filmmaker, has some kind of crazy ideas for reality TV shows. He's a very, really interesting guy. But no, he just is friends with Linda and happened to be available that day that I was in town. And I got him wired up for a mic and he just started talking, and I just stayed with him and we walked around. He bought me lunch. We had Dr. Pepper together. That's the one thing I was really appreciative of, is how generous everyone I met was with their time. Because some of the people I developed multi-year relationships with, like Matthew, the young storm chaser that appears in the film twice, I have known since 2021, and we have stayed in fairly close contact. We talk to each other online occasionally and things. And yeah, I'd known him for a few years, whereas everyone else I kind of like happened upon or met spontaneously, though that's not entirely true, because the two people in Lubbock, Texas, I had known for a couple years by the time we did the interview. But Oz Safe Rooms, the Twister Museum, these folks were people that I sort of met along the way.
Yeah, and you mentioned Oz Safe Rooms. There's an entire, I guess, warehouse you visit of a company where they build, I guess, tornado-proof rooms, sort of like the bomb shelters from the 50s, only it's for tornadoes, and they named it Oz. which I guess is where you go if a tornado comes, where you're going to be somewhat safe, is Oz in popular culture. Popular culture is what's interesting about this, is, and I wanted to ask you about this. You do talk to some young storm chasers, young men, and I don't know. I mean, other than in the Twister movies, it seems like most of the storm chasers are young men.
Though that's changing. I mean, you're starting to see like greater diversity in the number, in the type of storm chasers that are out there. But yeah, it still is kind of dominated by mostly young men.
I wonder, you know, you never heard so much about, I mean, it could just be also the development of technology, but this idea of storm chasers, amateur storm chasers, and now we have semi-professional, professional storm chasers. Is this because of the Twister movies and popularizing this? And did the people you talked to, were they inspired by what they saw in the movies, or were they inspired by a fascination with storms?
It differs by generation. So when you meet older storm chasers, almost everyone has like an event or something that they made contact with that they could sort of pinpoint as their moment of fascination. So sometimes it's that they experienced the tornado, because a lot of storm chasers are from the area and they just do it like as storms arise. But there are people who also like fly in. We don't talk to them, but the storm chasers at the very end of the film who pull up in like the Subarus and walk over and set their cameras up, we kind of observe. Those two men were from Australia. They were in Colorado from Melbourne for the purpose of storm chasing. So there is a, like an international component to this as well. But yeah, I mean, sometimes it's a fascination with tornadoes because of an event that they lived through. But oftentimes they say, you know, older storm chasers will say the Wizard of Oz in that opening sequence. And younger storm chasers will either say Twister if they're around my age. And if they're even younger, they often point to either like Reed Timmer and these Pecos Hank and these like YouTube personalities, or like the reality TV show Storm Chasers. Ethan, who is Matt's sort of sidekick, some people call him Silent Bob because he doesn't say anything in the film, but he's an interesting person that I would love to maybe do another film with at another time, because he lives an interesting life. But he told me about like watching the reality TV show. And so, yeah, it depends on the generation, but almost all of them have a connection through some sort of popular culture thing. And I think if you look at the patterns of storm chasing and how it's become more of a popular hobby and semi-professionalized for some people, that when you go back to like David Hoadley and the earliest people that were there prior to the movie Twister, it was also just a lot harder to do. Like, in order to get updates about weather, David Hoadley talks about like actually having to drive to weather stations and with his own map and write down the data as it's being reported to him, and then go out. And that's very difficult and requires a degree of specialized knowledge that you don't really need the same thing now. I mean, you really saw a first proliferation after the movie Twister, like things started to spike. You see manuals published about how to storm chase. I think it's Tim Vasquez has made a storm chaser's handbook. But now with like the way that storm chasing becomes a streaming event or becomes an online event, you see a further proliferation. Also, now everyone can have radar scope downloaded onto their phone that they pay $10 a month for. And suddenly they have like a pretty advanced real-time display of what's happening. And then like the College of DuPage in Illinois has created like a really great data visualizer for like amateur meteorologists to use to try to predict what things will look like a couple days out, so on and so forth. And so it's just become a lot more convenient and easy and affordable for people to get into this. And then during the pandemic, you saw a big spike in the number of people doing it, myself included, because it was one of the things you could actually do safely. You know, you're spending a lot of time by yourself just driving around. Your social distancing by default, you know, like there was a big spike around that time, to the point that now Oklahoma is even considering legislation requiring permitting for people who storm chase, because they've had several car accidents in the last few years of people like hydroplaning late at night and crashing their cars or running into one another. There have actually only been 4 documented instances of people being of storm chasers being killed directly by a tornado, which is mentioned in the film. And it was all one event. It was the El Reno tornado. But there have been dozens of people who have died storm chasing, and it's usually automotive accidents. And there's a brief moment at the end of the film where you see almost like traffic driving down a narrow rural street. And that's what they call like a storm chaser's convergence. And it can be kind of the times when I was storm chasing that felt most dangerous were when there were just a lot of people on the roads, because it's the infrastructure is not built for it. And sometimes you'll just spontaneously have 70 cars parked out in a field watching a storm. And, you know, there've been accidents and people getting killed or injured because of it. And so, yeah, it's become a thing where locals think it's a nuisance and the state thinks it's dangerous and they're talking about trying to regulate it. How effective that'll be or if that happens, I don't know, but it is the culture around it shifting. You can pay to go on tours. There's all sorts of stuff around it now.
Yeah, it is kind of a seemingly contradictory message with if the National Weather Service is telling you to go seek shelter and get in your basement and then somebody's having a storm chasing tour concurrently and simultaneously with that. It sort of seems to defeat the, I guess, the legitimacy and the authority of the Weather Service and their advisories.
And people get too confident that it's predictable, myself included. You think like, oh, I've done this a few times. I know how these things behave, but there's always the possibility that it will behave differently than you expect. And only people who are really trained in how to read that stuff in the field can really do it safely.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, as you are storm chasing and trying to get footage, I assume that most of the time you were doing this, you're trying to get footage. Did you feel that kind of exhilaration or thrill or what drives people to do this? And is that just about getting a shot as a filmmaker, or is there something else that you felt?
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of like the inherent risk to it that, you know, I think for someone like me is a bit thrilling, driving at or just above the speed limit down these roads, trying to catch up with storms that are trying to get away from you. The element of the chase does feel like a game almost, and it is exhilarating. Yeah, I mean, as a filmmaker, I'm often thinking about where can I place myself to get like scenes that I think will be useful for my film. So it's a lot about getting the shot, right? And I think that that's true for a lot of storm chasers if they're not part of like an actual research team. I've never met a storm chaser who's out there without a camera. You know, they've at least got their cell phone and they all intend to make images. And that was part of my interest in storm chasing is, you know, I'm not a meteorologist, but I'm a photographer by training. And for me, there's such a photographic quality to storm chasing and to tornadoes that was part of my initial interest. And so, yeah, there's the exhilaration of the chase, but there's also like, I think for most people, there's an inherent contradiction. There's both the feeling, the drive to go out to do these things is to record it into an image. And what fuels that desire is the images that you've seen of other people, right? Like you see someone else's tornado footage and you seek that out. And yet when you're there, there's a creeping knowledge that whatever you capture is going to be insufficient for what you're experiencing. So there's both like a desire for direct contact with these storms and to be near them and to sort of have like the experience of sublime. Because there is this like weird sort of humbling feeling out on the plains when you see these storms that are taller than Mount Everest kind of building in front of you. And they feel like these, you know, spontaneous and fleeting mountains on display, and how like your camera is never going to capture what it feels like to be in there when you feel the pressure changing and the temperature changing and the wind picking up and the calm and the sounds and all of that that are experiential that you're trying to replicate. You know, you always feel like you fall short of it, but at the same time, there's this drive to record it. So there's both like a need to record, but also a distrust in the record that you're making, and an interest in other people's images, but an understanding that those images are incomplete or insufficient to describe the experience. So there's like this way that you both are trying to make an image and understand that your image will never actually capture the thing that you are feeling.
Well, Curtis, thanks so much for talking to us today about this movie and about your work and your experiences making it. Look forward to seeing the film at the Heartland Hawk Film Festival at the Normal Theater in Uptown Normal on May 6th.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Curtis Miller is a filmmaker, artist, and educator based in Chicago, Illinois. In 2025, he was named one of Filmmaker Magazine's 25 New Faces of Independent Film. A Brief History of Chasing Storms, Miller's first documentary feature, will kick off the Heartland Hawk Film Festival presented by Heartland Community College. If you like this episode of Random Acts of Knowledge, feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.